just like to just let you know a little bit more about where I'm coming from and who I am, so that you know who's talking to you. I am a Catholic priest, and I am a member of a religious community that's 800 years old in the Catholic Church. It's called the Order of the Holy Cross, and that is the kind of the motivation for a lot of my work at dealing with suffering and ways to help people with suffering. So I have been a priest for 49 years. I've been a Crozier for 54. My experience is pretty vast. Most of my ministry life has been in the United States. However, and most of that's been in leadership in my religious community, both at local, national, and international levels. But I spent 9 years in the Congo, in Kinshasa. I was a formation director for young seminarians, the theological students. And then I spent 3 years working in Brazil. And I have lots of experience with Asia, with especially Indonesia. I would go to Papua New Guinea, which is kind of like the Amazon, regularly. I was responsible for that mission. So I'm well-versed in particularly the problems of suffering in the world, because in those parts of the world, of course, there's tremendous suffering. Not to ignore the suffering that we endure. So what I'd like to do, this is a kind of one presentation in three parts. Today, I want to focus on the issue of suffering. And then Wednesday, I want to talk about the pastoral instrument that I've developed to accompany people through suffering. They're called the Crozier Spiritual Exercises. And then on the final day, I'd like to really delve into that process of how we help people. And I have materials for you, which I will give you after this session, because they're particularly pertinent to this particular session. These spiritual exercises are the gift of the Spirit to me. I think it was the Spirit. About 10 years ago, we've been using them regularly. They are very, very effective for people who are enduring any kind of suffering. They are used for in groups. They're used on individual one-on-one. We have done these with great concern for people. And people come to do these exercises with all sorts of things. We've had people with cancer, people with relationship problems, people with family difficulties, people struggling with what they're supposed to do in their lives, people with addictions. So they fit anything that people are suffering. And the interesting thing, as you'll find out, is that this, all through these exercises, each of them is accompanied by a cross coach. So I want to just expose this to you. And for those of you who are pastors, you might find this helpful in your ministry. Now, I'm coming at it, of course, from a Catholic perspective, but it's very gospel-oriented. There's very little in it that's peculiar to one particular tradition. And so I hope that you will find it useful to yourselves and to the people that you are serving. So this first session I call Suffering. And when that's a code for me for a cross experience. So any experience of suffering, in some sense, can be seen as bearing the cross, bearing some kind of cross. And so that's the kind of model that I use for all of this. And today I want to talk about the roots of suffering. So it's a largely theological, but we'll reflect together on this. And just want to, in this first session, I would just like us to get in touch with suffering. And then I'll work you through in the next two sessions, if you come back through the spiritual exercise, and how we deal with it. Any questions for me before I begin? Anything I didn't say that you want to know? Anything you hope I'm not going to say that you don't want to know? All right. This is just a kind of a reaction moment. What are your reactions, thoughts, feelings when the subject of the cross, that is to say, suffering, comes up? So I just want you to watch the images, just record internally your reactions, and then we'll share just a little bit about it. So what are your reactions, thoughts, and feelings when the subject of this kind of suffering comes up? anything come to mind, to heart, to feelings about those images? Yes.
Why did Jesus have to suffer to atone for my sins?
The kinds of feelings or reactions to these images?
I guess when I see the cross, I think of relief that I know when my sins are forgiven and I can. It's kind of like a relief that I know I don't have to worry about what's coming next.
Okay. So there are visual reactions to suffering in the world. You know, we see things, we hear things. Not only that, we experience things ourselves, and so there's a lot of reaction. And of course, one of the biggest questions is always, why? These spiritual exercises are an attempt to put us in touch with, compassionate toward, and capable of assisting people with their experience of suffering, not just what they're going through, but even to some answers about why and what is it really all about. So that's what we'll be dealing with. So these exercises are come from an 800-year tradition of Christian life in a religious community. Somebody once asked me, boy, that's 800 years, that's a long time. Who wrote those 800 years ago? I said, well, nobody. That's why I wrote it 10 years ago. But it comes out of, you know, when you're in a tradition, the tradition becomes a part of you, and you give life to it. So those of you who are Lutherans, you know that the whole experience of Luther, his desire, his intention, formed a tradition, a theological tradition. And if you're Lutheran, you come out of that tradition, and you now speak like Lutherans and act like Lutherans and teach like Lutherans, pray like Lutherans. Well, it's the same with somebody that comes from an 800-year-old tradition of Christian life, and that's where these religious exercises come from. And we wanted to deal with the cross. Now, there are various perspectives on cross in its definition. So I'm going to be using an approach here that perhaps will be new to some of you, but I think it will be interesting and enriching even of your own theology. So what spiritual exercises want to do, they want to deal with the cross, and they want to make a certain theology of the cross applicable to suffering. So I want to be pastoral. That's basically what this is all about. How do you be pastoral to people who are suffering? So you take all those images, you know, that we put there. How are you pastoral to the starving kid? How are you pastoral to the person who's just experienced a terrible loss? How are you pastoral to someone who's suffering from cancer? How to be pastoral? And it's not easy for us. Those of you who are pastors know that this is difficult sometimes for us when we're with a person and we expect it to be some kind of blessing, some kind of help, and we struggle with it, I think, ourselves. So this is meant to help also us to answer some questions and then know how to help others. In these exercises, the suffering person makes his own theology of the cross. So we're not just interested in doing for somebody. You know, say, okay, here's the content. Put it in your head. Here are the feelings you really should have. Put them in your heart. It's not that kind of pastoral ministry, but it's a pastoral ministry that says, can we share a bit the meaning of what's happening to you, and the meaning in terms of the New Testament and Jesus' own redemptive activity. So in this particular perspective, the cross is seen as a path. So there's meaning in suffering. So the suffering takes us somewhere. It's a path. It's not just something we endure, something we have to put up with, something we hope goes away, but it's a path to something. And it's a path to becoming. Becoming really the person that we were meant to be, what we were created to be. The path, if we endure suffering, is meant to bring us somewhere. And in these exercises, it's always with the help of someone. That particular help in these exercises is called a cross coach, and I'll explain that to you as we go through. There's a certain pastoral method. So what God calls us to be and do, and so we're all on our way to full resurrection. You know, from the Gospel of John, we know that eternal life is already in us. Jesus says the kingdom is within, but it's not full yet. We know that. There's a great struggle in the early church and in the history about, well, if Jesus died for us, and everything, if he saved the world, what's the meaning of all this that's going on around us? But we know, and I like the parable of the weeds and wheat about this, and I use it often. The sower went out, the farmer went out, had his people sow wheat, and then somebody came and sowed weeds, and the workers came back and said, "What happened to your field?" And he, "I don't know." They said, "Well, we'll go out and pull up the weeds, and you can have the wheat." He said, "Don't do that. Wait until the end. Let them grow together." And I think this was a parable of Jesus that the early church used as a kind of initial eschatology, a kind of thinking about the end times. You know, so that our experience is weeds and wheat. I don't know anybody who doesn't experience weeds and wheat in our lives. And so the question is, you know, what do you do when you are experiencing the weeds? When you know that the wheat, Jesus has already accomplished for us. So what's this, you know, what is this all about? And so what the spiritual exercises want to do is they want to help people with the weeds and to help them move, to discover and to move toward the call in whatever it is they're suffering, so that in the end, we are more risen than when we began. If you have any questions, please. The method of these exercises are a series of conversations. So you'll see that when I give you the material. There, in every section of these exercises, there is a conversation with the self. So we're very keen on helping people get in touch with what's really happening. And so we use a lot of contemporary methodology to help people get in touch with what's going on inside. And they're having a conversation with themselves about their suffering. And then there's a conversation with God. So they take that kind of understanding of what's happening to them and they talk to God about it. And that's there's a very careful direction, spiritual direction that we give them about which God you talk to. And I will explain that as we go through. And then, of course, the third conversation is with the cross coach. So this is a personal counselor, a personal spiritual director that every member, every participant in the spiritual exercises has as he or she goes through the exercises. So it's all about accompaniment. And I think this is critical for these exercises. I think people, it would be very difficult for people to make the exercises without this kind of accompaniment because it is a very deep personal experience. So the exercises use these conversations. Now the spiritual exercises have four movements, and each movement has a particular instructional piece and then a task piece. So the instructional piece will give a basic teaching, a basic information, theological perspective, and then the participants deal with it personally in a task.
usually with writing.
So the first movement, and I gave these Latin names because, you know, it's kind of mystical, you know? People like that kind of stuff. and this is a common phrase anyway, via sacris. It has to do with the movement of Jesus through Jerusalem. And the text, the fundamental text, was that he set his face toward Jerusalem, with Jerusalem symbolizing, you know, the ultimate experience of suffering in his life. And so that journey, we'll talk about that, his journey and the journey of the Christian, of via sacris. And then we ask people to reflect on that. The second movement is called Calvaria. That's the place of the skull where Jesus died. He went out to what is called the place of the skull. And in this second movement, we focus people very intentionally on trying to describe the suffering in from various dimensions of their life. Because we use this language, an experience of suffering is the experience of being in a skull place, a Calvary. And therefore, we should try to know that skull place. And you'll see why we need to know that as I unfold these spiritual exercises to you. And the task of this is a very careful inventory of the suffering. The third movement, In Tenebris, in the Darkness, has to do with the darkness that surrounded the cross of Jesus from the sixth to the ninth hour. And in this particular movement, we talk about the experience of darkness as a traditional Christian experience of people who are suffering, who feel abandoned, as Jesus did on the cross. And, you know, that whole idea of it's another way of talking about suffering from the Christian point of view. And this is the movement that people don't like, because this is the movement where we actually accompany them in the experience of their suffering, and they need to discover more and more, and they need to talk more and more and pray more and more about what's actually going on. And it's an extensive movement. So we use the 4 hours, 6 hours, 7th hour, 8th hour, and 9th hour, and there are exercises for that, spiritual exercises. So it's very interesting, and most people don't like this part because it's the most difficult. Now, by the way, these spiritual exercises sometimes can take months. So I remember a religious a brother who came to Phoenix from another place in the United States, and he had been accused of sexual misconduct, sexual abuse, and he needed to work through all of that. So we took about 6 months, so helping him to identify what is actually going on inside you. I mean, if he actually abused, what that was about, if he was just being accused, and we had to get through all of that. And he left risen. Doesn't mean that all the problems were solved, but he could come out of it with a deeper faith and a greater confidence for his life. And the fourth movement, everybody likes this one, Pax Vobis, peace be with you. This is the movement that talks about the resurrection. And how we're all always being resurrected, and that every experience of suffering appropriately in faith handled leads to some kind of resurrection. So that people like that one, they're glad the third one's over and they're into the fourth one, which is kind of celebratory. So those are the four movements, and I have all of that material for you, and I'll give that to you when you leave, and so you can kind of look at it when you come back. So these spiritual exercises are a pastoral tool, fundamentally a pastoral tool. So first, what do you say to suffering people? What's the message? So what's your script? So any of us who've gone into hospitals, we know, or dealing with grief, or some tragedy. I mean, you know, this, I mean, it is, I suppose, and some ministers, I think, are perfectly comfortable. We come with our Bible verses, and we come with, you know, our prayers for this or that particular occasion, and you know, but sometimes it doesn't work. They aren't ready for it. You know, so what's my script? You know, how do I know what to say? Secondly, how to be with people who are suffering. So, well, I mean, that's easy. You just are with them. And I'm not so sure it's that easy. How do you be with people that are suffering? How do you, for example, just your own, the kind of presence you have, how long you're with them. So some suffering people need to be accompanied for weeks, months. And you know, we have to know how to be with people. There's a certain technique, if you want, about that. And then finally, answering their question about why did I lose this baby in the last month of my pregnancy? Why did this very wonderful young woman who had a great future ahead of her get killed in this head-on collision? Why didn't my father see that his drinking was going to kill him? You know, people have great, well, how do you answer those questions? So part of what the spiritual exercises wants to do for the minister is to help that person a little bit with how to answer, where does suffering go? So if you want to know, the script idea comes in the first movement. That's where we get into a kind of fundamental perspective. In the second and third movements, we talk about technique, how to be present, how to accompany. And in the fourth movement, we talk about outcome. So where is it leading? So the spiritual exercises are fashioned to go somewhere. So the minister, whether ordained or lay, because oftentimes, you know, I mean, I don't know how many of you are ordained, but the ordained ministers, you know, they're fairly prepared and they are used to dealing with that kind of stuff. But, you know, the sister-in-law of somebody or somebody's mother, when they're dealing with suffering people or a friend, a good friend, when they go, you know, they're all ministers. They're all having to, you know, to accompany this person. So all of this is about, no matter whether you're ordained or not, about that kind of accompaniment. And that makes you a cross coach in our estimation. So anybody who is accompanying with any kind of sensitivity, theological perspective, and people don't have to be theologians, go to seminary for this kind of stuff. I mean, some very ordinary people, very deep faith, who understand the gospel and who live it and who can speak, you know, meaningfully to others. They're cross coaches when they're dealing with somebody who's suffering. If they're, you know, so anybody who is in effect ministering effectively to someone who's suffering is considered a cross coach. And the people who serve in these exercises as cross coaches are people who are prepared. So we insist that they are trained spiritual directors. And a number of our cross coaches are not Catholics, so they participate as cross coaching, you know, in these exercises. We want them to have experienced the exercises first before they, because it makes a difference, you know. So if they're dealing with whatever's here, then they're able to listen better to the others. In Phoenix, I do a lot of Hispanic ministry. I have a little school to train lay Latino spiritual directors. Lay Latino spiritual directors is kind of like a revolution. First of all, lay, I mean, in the Catholic Church, you know, there's been for centuries, Martin Luther never convinced us otherwise. It took him 500 years for us to get to this point of view after the Second Vatican Council, but, you know, that lay people could serve as directors of souls. Why not? Now, that doesn't mean just anybody can do it. I mean, there are some, you know. But in Phoenix, what we do is we have a school. I've got 28 people now training. It's a two-year program. And but in the Latino community, it's even worse. I mean, Latino culture is only, you know, they're the privileged spiritual leaders, and then they're the rest of you. You know, the privileged ones are the ordained or the consecrated or whatever. And it's a kind of a revolution. And our people, when they come in, belong to that culture and are lay, and they have to go through a whole transformation of mentality and spirit to be able to assist. But I insist that they make these exercises and they become cross coaches when we're doing programs for others. Cross coaches, not somebody just off the street. I think when we're giving programs, we have to be assured that cross coaches can be effective because of their formation, and we try to give them a formation. But that doesn't mean that someone who doesn't have formal training can't serve well in this kind of ministry. But when you're pulling people together for an experience like this, you better have it right. So I just want to let you know what's coming down the road so that you can say, well, maybe I can come back tomorrow on the third time to see how this goes. And maybe there are people you may say, well, you know, I think Susan should be here for this. Or I know the pastor is always talking about this, and he's here, I think I'll invite him. People can come in. It's not that they'll miss because they missed the first one. They, of course, will miss something. But so don't be afraid to invite anybody that you think might profit by this. Any questions or observations before I get into the particular material? How are you reacting to this? Is this does this sound strange to you?
No, it doesn't sound strange. But I was just thinking about suffering and my usual personal response to it has been as of late, oh great, another opportunity to grow, yay. Like, I mean, and not meaning that yay, but I think I like accompaniment part seems to be really important. I think most of us spend a lot of time sort of trying to shuffle through our suffering alone. And
not even Jesus did that. I mean, you know, when you follow his journey, not even Jesus did that. This idea that another opportunity to grow, we're going to build on that significantly. And we're going to build it in such a way that it comes deeply out of faith and not just kind of a philosophical position that helps us get through it.
Like, oh, great.
Yeah. Any other reactions to what you've heard? Okay. So, as I said, I want to just get us in touch, you know, with our own, some of our experiences or even some of our thoughts about suffering. So I want to take you through some things that I think will be interesting. I hope will be interesting for you. So if we take a map of human suffering, it is both personal and communal. So it's both personal and social. I mean, it's not just individual people, but it are groups of people that are organized into families, into communities, into states, into countries, organizations. I mean, there's suffering that goes on in a communal context as well as a personal context. And I think this pretty much maps out the areas where people, human beings, experience suffering. First of all, there's suffering in our bodies. Never had a headache, or, you know, never had appendicitis, or ever given birth to a baby, or, you know, I mean, everybody. We all know that. So that suffering is, we're all in touch with physical suffering, and that physical suffering can be mild or can be excruciating, you know. So you know people, I'm sure. Maybe you know people who are right now in tremendous, have tremendous physical challenges, you know. Even things like arthritis or getting around. I mean, I have a lot of difficulty with that, and as I age, and the aging part of it also is, you know, part of the physical. So we're very physical. And God is very aware of us as physical. That's why the promise of final resurrection. We can't be anything but physical. We're bodies. That's who we are. We're not, you know, I often wonder about this time between the time we die and the time of final restoration. You know, what's that going to feel like to me? Because I'm without my the expression of myself, physical expression of myself. You know? But in the end, you see, that's given to us. So. But there's this physical suffering that's unbelievable, what happens to people. And as I say, you may know people right now who are suffering tremendously. Then there's mental suffering too, that's stuff in the mind. People, well, tell me, what would be some of the examples of mental suffering that you could name?
Depression.
Forgetfulness.
Anywhere where the mind is not doing what it's supposed to be doing. You know, so it's like it gets, you know, confusion. Errors. You know, we don't calculate well sometimes. It gets us in deep trouble sometimes, doesn't it? When we're not sharp enough to know what's going on. We don't know, you know. And people suffer mental illness. Boy, is that an awful. I mean, it's mental. It's you know, it's in the mind. There may be roots of it, you know, physiological roots or chemical brain kinds of things. But nonetheless, you know, if you are schizophrenic. You are bipolar. Oh my. A terrible, terrible suffering, you know. And it's just how can we be with people, and how do you give meaning to somebody who's schizophrenic, who may not be able even to hear at a particular moment the reality of anything? But it's still a human being, and still has some, you know, and is searching like everybody else for meaning in life. So mental illness is a terrible personal, it can be a terrible person. Emotional illness, what would that be?
Divorce or grief?
I would say that when we talk about emotional, it would be what happens to you internally when, for example, there is this break of relationship. So what happens internally? And so it could be things like rage,
sadness,
jealousy,
hopelessness,
despair. You know, and people do have trouble with that. I mean, there are times when we're under control, and there are times when we're not under control. And people who have a tendency to not be under control in this or that area of their emotional life, it can be torturous for them, and it can cause all kinds of problems. You know, so you fly off the handle because you're not in control of what's going on inside you, and you're damaging your marriage and your relationships with your children, or You know, I mean, there's, and people so regret this, you know, this disturbance inside. There's kind of a storm, you know, inside. It's like feelings become tyrants. Feelings dominate even your head. You know, that's kind of an emotional suffering for people. Social suffering. What might that be? So yes, and what actually poverty does to people. Yeah. So it's that whole experience, you know, of there's social suffering. I'm out, you know. And that whatever that does to me.
Discrimination because of race or religion?
Absolutely. Discrimination is social suffering. And how many people today feel that? And all over the world. Yeah.
Bullying with kids.
Bullying. Those bullied, and eventually the bullier is suffering from the social dimension. When you think about, and then you get into the questions of, you know, like this violence that we live with, and people afraid to go out on the street, and people scared to death for their kids, and, you know, I mean, it's like, are you kidding? It's a lot of social suffering for people. Even social suffering can even be living in a bad marriage. You know, where day by day facing a spouse that's hell to live with. Being part of an ethnic group that's unacceptable. In Phoenix, you know, when some of the raids were going on with the government raids of illegal people who are without documents, horrible kinds of experiences people were having. Even those who were Americans and being profiled. You see, it's all this social suffering that happens to people.
Yeah, and I kind of wonder what we have in store when I think about our children going to school with the fear of being killed.
What's
happening? This is like a new recent phenomenon.
Yes.
Just tolerance for that kind of violence to our children.
It's social suffering. It really is. Moral suffering. What about moral suffering? How would you talk about moral suffering? What's moral suffering?
Well, when, without meaning to, you've done something that really hurt somebody, and there's nothing you can do to help.
That's right. So there's the question of not acting rightly and of hurting people, and then the remorse you feel, you know? Or not knowing right from wrong. And there are people like that. They don't know right from wrong. We've lost the tradition of right and wrong. I mean, they talk about it today, about, you know, there's just like, it's just wide open. I mean, what do you appeal to in terms of a value system? If some people don't have any value systems, or theirs is very, very minimal, and they go through life like that, you know. So the moral suffering that we go through is sometimes, or being victim of a lack of morality on the parts of other people. And then the question of spiritual suffering. So what's spiritual suffering?
In Keelan, Keelan, the town, when we were there yesterday, we were walking around, and my wife and I were by the Riverside Park, and a gal was there. We just started a conversation, and I don't know if we felt safe to her, but she started unloading on us. And I diagnosed it as her feeling betrayed by God because her life was such a mess.
Yeah.
And that she had tattoos of psalms, and, you know, I'm a Christian, I got this psalm, how come my life is a mess? I biked across America, I was witnessing, how come my life is a mess?
Exactly.
And
yeah.
So
spiritual suffering.
She had these demons, and she had, I told her, well, I think you feel like like you've been betrayed. Well, yeah, you know, and you can't sit down and have a counseling session, so it's what you do sitting at a picnic table out in the middle of a strange town.
You were cross-coaching and in a very informal situation. So that's an example of spiritual suffering. Spiritual suffering might include, like, I don't know if I believe anymore.
I can forgive.
Yeah, just don't know. Or I can't pray. Used to be able to pray, can't pray anymore. Or don't pray well. Or you know, it's just all kinds of, it all has to do with this relationship with God business, and that can be the cause of great suffering interiorly to people. And it is. And I think all of us at some time or other have some kind of spiritual suffering.
I have to excuse myself. I'm going to be back tomorrow, but this next thing is only happening today.
So. God bless you. Thanks for coming. So, and then, you know, so that's the personal side of it. Then you have this whole communal side, physical suffering communal. So this might be that a whole community, for example, is denied access to what it needs to be healthy. A whole community is denied adequate food, water. It's, you know, it's a kind of a common social, communal, physical suffering. And mental, too. A society that has gone crazy. No, so for example, totalitarian societies. You know what that must be like for people who have even an inkling that there's something not to have to suffer totalitarianism. And I know what that's like because I spent my 9 years in Africa and I lived under a dictator. There's several of them. A whole society that kind of, who are we, where are we going? Emotional. You know, you can get lots of emotional suffering. So, for example, the whole gay movement, the gay community. You know, there's a certain amount of emotional suffering that goes on because of people don't understand, people don't accept. You get this kind of communal suffering emotionally too, or certain ethnic groups. So, groups that are profiled. Suffer as a group. You know, just do. I remember I taught in New York for a year and in a school in White Plains, Brattler, up in the area. And I was told that there were certain neighborhoods in that area whereas I, as an Italian American, would not be welcome. Just because my family, I mean, let's talk about, you know, social suffering and moral suffering. You can have whole societies that have degenerated because, for example, of poor leadership, have degenerated into kind of like, back in the 60s, there were books about that. What was that? I'm getting old. Like Animal Farm and what was that one that caused a lot of... Anyway, it's like whole societies that morally have lost their compass. Just lost their compass. And not good for anybody. And especially for them because they're morally deteriorating. And then spiritually too. Whole societies, for example, Europe. I don't know if you have been to Europe or lived. I've lived in Europe. Europe has become terribly secular. You think our country is secular? Now that's a spiritual suffering for a lot of people who still remember their religious roots, and a lot of people who now don't have any spiritual roots and kind of wandering around. It's like there's a spiritual suffering of a group, like it could be a whole country, a whole culture. There's lots and lots of suffering going on. So I think there's plenty of call for and room for cross-coaching in our world. And it's very complex. And that's why we really need to be, you know, prepared as Christians to be able to deal with this. Now, I want to just use something from my own tradition, from the Church of the Modern World. When the Second Vatican Council back in the early 60s, one of the documents, at the beginning of the document, started talking about why these bishops had gotten together, what was going on in the world. And I just want to just read some of this with you. So this is something that was the document on the church. Never has the human race enjoyed such an abundance of wealth, resources, and economic power, and yet a huge proportion of the world's citizens are still tormented by hunger and poverty, while countless numbers suffer from total illiteracy. This was 50 years ago. Could have been written yesterday. Never before has humanity been so keen, has had so keen an understanding of freedom, yet at the same time, new forms of social and psychological slavery make their appearance. Although the world of today has a very vivid awareness of its unity and how one person depends on another in need of solidarity, it is most grievously torn into opposing camps by conflicting forces. For political, social, economic, racial, and ideological disputes still continue bitterly, and with them the peril of a war which would reduce everything to ashes. It's called nuclear. True, there is a growing exchange of ideas, but the very words by which key concepts are expressed take on quite different meanings in diverse ideological systems. Finally, humanity painstakingly searches for a better world without a corresponding spiritual advancement. Why? Sound familiar? From your experience, huh? Today's spiritual agitation and the changing conditions are part of a broader and deeper revolution. As a result of the latter, the intellectual formation is ever increasingly based on the mathematical and natural sciences and on those dealing with humanity itself, while in the practical order, the technology which stems from these sciences takes on mounting importance. And this is that whole business about the kind of like the mind, the human knowledge, has somehow gotten detached from its base. It is also noteworthy how many people are being induced to migrate on various counts and are thereby changing their manner of life. Even now it's even worse than it was then. Today's spiritual agitation and the changing conditions of life are part of the institutions, laws, and modes of thinking and feeling as handed down from previous generations do not always seem to be well adapted to the contemporary state of affairs. Hence arises an upheaval in the manner and even the norms of behavior. Cool. Talk to parents, bringing up their kids. It's just like, wait a minute, where are you getting those ideas? Finally, these new conditions have their impact on religion. Growing numbers of people are abandoning religions in practice. Unlike former days, the denial of God or of religion or the abandonment of them are no longer unusual and individual occurrences. For today, it is not rare for such things to be presented as requirements of scientific progress or of a certain new humanism. In numerous places, these views are voiced not only in the teachings of philosophers, but on every side they influence literature, the arts, the interpretation of the humanities, and of history and civil laws themselves. As a consequence, many people are shaken. Within the individual person, there develops rather frequently an imbalance between an intellect which is modern in practical matters and a theoretical system of thought which can neither master the sum total of its ideas nor arrange them adequately into a synthesis. So it's like, oh, this information out there, it's just all there, but we can't get it all together to say, is this human? Likewise, an imbalance arises between a concern for practicality and efficiency and the demands of moral conscience, which also very often between the conditions of collective existence and the requisites of personal thought, and even of contemplation. At length, there develops an imbalance between the specialized human activity and a comprehensive view of reality. And anybody who goes to the doctor today knows that. One doctor does not communicate with the other doctor. Everybody's specialized. You used to be able to go, remember the doctor, I remember, the doctor was the general. You could go to him, and he knew what was wrong with your toe as well as your heart. No. Everybody has his specialty, and it's driving us crazy. As for the family, discord results from population, economic, and social pressures, or from difficulties which arise between succeeding generations or new social relationships between men and women. Talk about the confusion in our families today. Differences crop up, too, between races and between various kinds of social orders, between wealthy nations and those which are less influential or are needy. Finally, between international institutions born of the popular desire for peace and the ambition to propagate one's own ideology, as well as collective greed existing in nations or other groups, what results is mutual distrust, enmities, conflicts, and hardships. Of such is humanity at once the cause and the victim. And, I mean, I can bear witness to that. I mean, you know, I've been in places, lived in places. People hounded by hunger call upon those better off. Where they have not yet won it, women claim for themselves inequity with men before the law and in fact. This was 50 years ago. Can you imagine today? In the face of the modern development of the world, the number constantly swells of the people who raise the most basic questions or recognize them with a new sharpness. And this is also true. What is humanity? What is this sense of sorrow, of evil, of death, which continues to exist despite so much progress? What purpose have these victories purchased at so high a cost? What can people offer to society? What can it expect from it? What follows this earthly life? Now, I use these texts simply to put us in the context of suffering. I mean, suffering's real. It's going on all around us, both in us and around us. It's going on locally, it's going on internationally. This is the, in a sense, kind of the fate of humanity, suffering. And what to do about it is the big question. So, there are a number of answers to this. Why humans suffer? What time do I have to quit? Buddhism says that the root of suffering is human desire. That's what causes all suffering. Hinduism says it's illusion. What we see out there is not real. The real is hidden. And therefore, when we live by what's out there, we're living by illusion, it causes suffering. Taoism, like the Asian kind of Eastern, is disharmony. Things are not put together right. Confucianism is untoward behavior, so people don't behave right. If you, yeah, that's cause of suffering. Animism. I lived in an animistic culture. This is, you know, where. The big deal is get control of the natural powers. Get a one-upsmanship on, you know, the river, on the clouds, you know, because there's such an imbalance of power. So the imbalance of cosmic power, and that's what causes suffering. Islam says it's non-submission to Allah. That's what causes suffering. Or sometimes suffering by them is considered a test of Allah, their fidelity. Judaism, Christianity, fundamentally sin. We'll talk a little bit more about that. What is the root of suffering? And in the New Testament, also in Judaism a bit, there's some idea that suffering sometimes is the discipline of our Father from Hebrews or a test. But fundamentally, it's sin. So, when Judaism talks about this, it talks about the garden and sin. There's a disconnect by the sin of Adam and Eve. Disconnect from God, a disconnect from others, and a disconnect from creation. So, our point of view is that suffering is rooted in this disconnect from God. That's a deliberate decision on the part of humanity. And therefore, human passions, which are great and glorious, go awry. So, for example, there are three fundamental human passions. You know this from your philosophy and theology courses. Ownership. Well, we have the right to have so that we can survive. Houses, land, money, resources. But what happens to us? You see, in the garden, there was no problem with ownership. But afterwards, when it goes crazy, what happens? People gobble up and other people don't have anything. The second passion is the passion for relationship, fundamental, belonging. But what happens in this desire to belong? It gets all messed up, it gets all convoluted, it gets abusive, it gets violent. What? That passion to be related, to belong, to love is wonderful, but boy, does it go bad. And then freedom. And freedom is the idea that I have a destiny and God has placed in me the power to move toward it. I can make decisions to become who I am. But what do? I can make my decisions irrespective of the others and trumps on everybody. My destiny is the most important one. I don't care about you. That's a misuse of freedom. That's called the misuse of power. So when you think about the Judeo-Christian point of view, it's like, boy, that no of Adam and Eve wrecked everything. And then there are all kinds of sin stories in Israel, and we won't go through these, the fall, Cain and Abel. Once the decision was made, out of the garden they go, and life falls apart. Their kids start killing each other. Genesis. Noah and the flood. So bad, God thought, I've got to start over. Wash it away. The sin cycle of Israelite history, this is very clear in the story of the judges. There's infidelity by the people, and then they're being punished by invasion from other countries and other armies. A judge comes and, as a military leader, liberates everything. They get safe again. It's wonderful. Back to infidelity, and the cycle goes. That's the story of the Old Testament. Then you have the prophets who constantly were speaking against the infidelity to the covenant. And then there's Job, poor Job. The whole book of Job is about human suffering. What's the meaning of it? Here's this great guy who loses everything. His friends come, give him speeches. But it's your fault. Repent. And you say, I didn't do anything. Finally, he starts to crack. But God intervenes and asks him some serious questions that makes him think, oh boy, just keep my mouth shut. The whole problem of why suffering. The why of Christianity in Jesus, as we can see, is he also belongs to this tradition that sin is the reason he came to redeem from sin. And that leads us to the new kingdom, the final glory. But there's a kind of a minor thing in some of Jesus, the way he handles suffering, is that sometimes suffering isn't because of sin, but it serves the glory of God. So God permits something to happen so that his glory can be shown. But that's a minor theme. And then in Hebrews, people don't like this, but because we have such a loving God, sometimes suffering is a test. Or is the discipline, as Hebrews speaks about, the discipline of our Father. Okay. We can keep it, but sometimes it. But fundamentally, for us Christians, and even the testing and the discipline has to do with something breaking down. See, and that's rooted in sin. Now, very quickly, how suffering is overcome. In Buddhism, kill desire. Practice yoga. Because that's what yoga does. Yoga is a spiritual discipline that reduces almost to nothing human desire. And there's this movement into nirvana, which is the complete lack of desire. In Hinduism, it's escape from illusion. So and that also use yoga for that. And the idea of reincarnation. So you can come back and make, got a second chance. Try it again. In Taoism, it's get unified with the cosmic world, get unified with the universe. That will be not cause suffering. In Confucianism, it's etiquette. If the idea is, poor manners, untoward behavior, if you learn how, so Confucius says, it's all that stuff. That's salvation to Confucian. To the animist, it's magic. It's like doing those rituals, making sure that river is controlled, making sure that the spirit and the animals are controlled, doing all that, magic. That's where you avoid suffering. Islam, the five pillars. If you observe the five pillars, profess Muhammad as the prophet, fast during Ramadan, almsgiving, they're very, very charitable, pray five times a day, and visit Mecca once in your lifetime, you're being obedient to Allah. And that's no suffering. Of course, getting all that done. In Judaism, it's wisdom, really. And wisdom in Judaism is defined as the fear of the Lord. So people who live fearing the Lord in that sense of being in touch with what God wants and living with God's will, suffering is diminished. And actually, the Old Testament talks about that. If you have fear of the Lord, you'll have prosperity, you'll have peace, long life. See? It's all that fear of the Lord, which is called wisdom. And then in Christianity, it's redemption. That's how suffering stops, by redemption. And that's where we're going to pick up for the rest of the presentation. Oh, I got that. So we're going to be talking about a Christian theology of Paschal mystery, which is the issue of redemption in the New Testament.